Hi, Michelle. Thanks for taking the time to talk to me. I feel really lucky actually to get time on your schedule since you're busy talking to The Economist and The Wall Street Journal and all these sorts of publications right now. This is a big moment for your gray rhino discussion, right?
It is, but of course, I'm always very, very happy to talk to you. So it's actually nice to have a little break from the storm.
Right, exactly. And just for people who aren't familiar with it, because I've read your book, The Gray Rhino, and talk about it, but the reason that it's coming up today is because that this pandemic is maybe a wonderful example of a gray rhino, a risk that is obvious that we've kind of seen stampeding towards us, or some people have been seeing and shouting about, and yet done nothing about until we're here on the tusks of the rhino right now, right? Whoops. So the challenge for you has been to step up and say this is in fact a gray rhino and not, as some would like to say, an unforeseeable, completely out of the blue surprise, the black swan, right?
Yeah, it has been. Well, the concept I first came up with in 2012, and then launched it in January 2013 at the World Economic Forum in Davos. The YouTube video is up there still, and developed the concept further into the book that came out in 2016. And unlike the black swan, another familiar concept that people just say, "Oh, that's a black swan," and then move on and hope that people think they're smart and actually read that book. The gray rhino actually has a framework. There are 5 stages of a gray rhino crisis that help you to understand, why you're not dealing with the obvious, and to think about the people around you to help you to diagnose it, to get to a stage of urgency and action. So it came out in 2016 in the U.S., and we had a couple of strokes of bad luck. One is that it was launched on the Upper West Side in New York City, standing room only in the Barnes and Noble, and that was great. And I had so many media connections that they doubled the print run of the advance copies. But I only found out sort of too late to do anything about them that a fair number of them went out with the pages out of order.
No.
So it was sort of a double whammy of bad luck, because it was the week of the New York primary in 2016, which was the first time in my memory that that primary had ever been relevant. And so there was no air in the room, and all my other friends who had books come out that year also had lots and lots of trouble. So it found audiences in particular areas in policy and financial planning. But it didn't start really getting big until it came out in China the next year, in February of 2017.
Yeah, well, it is such a global topic, and talks to people with global, concerns about global risks, as well as personal. I mean, you can read it on every level. Yeah, but so I want to get to, and something you kind of said, you created this framework. You were talking about this in 2013. But yeah, so how do we get to this point where you, Michelle, are talking with, are writing books that world leaders are reading, right, putting on their bookshelf, or talking about risk on a global scale? That's a pretty big platform to build. So how did you get to this place? Now, I know that this is not your first book, but this is the one that's really built your platform as it is today, right?
Yeah, it really is very global. I'm very lucky that I've got a fantastic global network. I made my first trip abroad when I was 16. I spent the summer in Europe, a month in Germany, and then a month in Belgium with relatives there. The last summer of college I spent in the Dominican Republic, and I wasn't supposed to go to Haiti under the terms of my grant because they just had a coup, but I did. I don't think they'll catch me now.
Okay, we can dodge that one.
Don't think I'll get into trouble.
No.
And I went back the next year and spent a year in the Dominican Republic and Haiti. And have traveled all around Latin America in my work as a financial journalist, and lots of work in Europe, particularly around immigration. Got invited to a lot of conferences there, and went to Asia for the first time in 2008 or 9. 2009 went to Japan, and then much more to China recently. the China thing was a sort of a complete surprise. Either my publisher forgot to tell me that they'd licensed it in China, or the email went astray, who knows, but there were bidding wars before the book was even done in Korea and Japan, and there was a Hungarian edition also licensed before it was even finished. Like, I was waiting to get my edits back from my editor. And when I got the, I think it was the Taiwan news, and you know, there was a bidding war, and my agent said, wow, this is a phenomenal amount for Taiwan. I emailed it back, and I said, if anyone asks me when I knew that this was going to be big, this this was it. You know, so I had an inkling, and of course, I've got friends in all of these places, and we've got these great technologies now that make it much easier to keep up with them than it used to be. But anyway, so I knew that there was a Taiwan edition. And early in 2017, the editor emailed me, the publisher emailed me and said, Chinese publisher has a question. You talk about your sister. They need to know if it was your big sister or little sister, because it's different words in Chinese. And I assumed it was for Taiwan. And then a couple weeks later, they emailed and they said, can you send us a video? Because your publisher has 80 bookstores and airports in China, and they have, you know, video monitors, and they want to broadcast that. So I was like, okay, this is not Taiwan, you know, apart from the fact that the Taiwan edition is traditional characters and the mainland edition is simplified characters.
Right.
So it took a little while to get the video together, because they wanted a certain format, and I needed to get an extra camera for it. So I emailed them, and you know, a couple weeks later, and I said, I just wanted to be sure that you got the video. And she emails back and says, yes, we got the video, and you'll be happy to know that your book's already in its third printing.
Oh my God.
30,000 copies.
Wow.
I wrote her back, is that 30,000 with 40s?
Yeah, right.
Yes.
Wow.
So I take absolutely no credit for that. My publisher in China has done a fantastic job of getting the word out. And then, of course, later that summer, it was discussed at the very highest level behind closed doors at a national financial planning meeting. And an editorial came out on the front page of People's Daily saying, watch out, not just for black swans or, you know, highly improbable risks, but also the very obvious gray rhinos. And they listed several financial risks, you know, the overheated real estate market and shadow banking and things like that. And the riskiest stocks fell by 5% in a single day.
Wow.
Yeah. So that was crazy. And that's, so then there was a bunch of media in the US about it. And the book has kept making news since then. Yeah. And this year I have a little spreadsheet I keep track. It's been about 200 mentions in more than 40 countries.
Wow. Wow, that's terrific. I mean, well, talk about an evergreen subject. I mean, you've got an evergreen subject. So although your timing on the launch wasn't maybe fortuitous for a big, you know, US launch, there is no end date to the concept of dealing with this kind of risk, because this is something we're going to have with us all the time, right?
It's true. Well, you know, there's a publication in London that came out with a story earlier this year, and this was even before the pandemic was in full swing, and they called it a metaphor for our times.
Yeah. Yeah. That's great.
Which was very appropriate. Came out on the cover of another publication in the UK, that talks about ESG, or, you know, environmental, social and governance elements of investing. So I basically, you know, every once in a while there's a little news burst, and I make sure that I'm available to do interviews and to respond to requests. But this year has been a whole other level. I got a call early in March from a reporter at Axios who had seen the TED Talk I did last year. And that last count, it's about 2.3 million views since it went up about a year ago. And she said she had just loved this gray rhino concept and finally had a chance to write about it. So she did a piece on, you know, climate change and the pandemic being gray rhinos. And then Fast Company picked it up, said the pandemic is not a black swan, it's a gray rhino. And then it just kept building. The next week I did an op-ed in the Washington Post which was then quoted in the Wall Street Journal. And then I was on the Economist podcast, and I've been doing lots and lots of interviews, all kinds, actually, lots of podcasts. I've been particularly doing a lot of very specific audiences on, you know, corporate governance, risk management, certainly the ESG. Very, very happy to talk with, you know, with audiences who can apply my work in their daily business, which is very, very important to me. That it's not just a book that sits and gets dust on the shelf, right. But it's something that people can use.
Yeah, I mean, you've done more than, I mean, you've written the book, you've created the framework, you've written the book, but now the platform is much bigger. I mean, you've got this TED Talk with those 2.3 million views. You know, you're finding different ways to reach people. You're working through journalism. You're doing videos. You're focusing on specific industries. You're doing all the things to take it to the next level and expand its reach. So, and are you are consulting? I mean, this has a platform and life of its own as well, right? Is that?
Yeah. Well, when the book came out, I set up a website, thegrayrhino.com, and started. It was actually kind of painful switching my business email correspondence over there, because there are people who'd been emailing me on my personal address for years and years and years, and there's still some stuff that I do there, but have been doing a number of like keynotes and workshops, which of course have moved online these days.
Yeah.
The workshops are sort of like a hybrid of training and consulting, where I will take some issue that's important to the group. I've done some on reskilling, on workforce changes, on new financial technologies. And if there's been a lot of demand actually for sort of career and personal leadership skills. Mm-hmm. I've been very surprised. I wrote the book as a, you know, policy and finance and, you know, business strategy person. And I've been blown away by the number of people who want more and more and more on how to apply this to their personal lives and to their personal challenges. And of course, that business leadership is, you know, sort of straddles the two. But I've been doing lots of these workshops for trade groups, for individual companies. And if those people usually will buy copies of the book, and they'll email me back as to how they've applied the concept in their careers, in their companies. And I just absolutely love that. When I go to China, I tend to talk more on a macro level.
Yeah.
The last talk I did in China was almost a year ago in Hangzhou, which is just to the south of Shanghai. And they wanted to go into more depth on the list I do every year of the top global gray rhinos, which is a meta list. I look at all the top risks and outlooks and predictions and forecasts. They're all, it's kind of apples and oranges and pears and kiwis, because they all come from a slightly different angle. So the last 5 years I've done a meta list saying, you know, what's on people's minds, partly so that when a big thing happens and people come out and say, oh, it's a black swan, nobody saw it coming, I can go back and say, okay, you know, here are all the really smart people who said it was coming. So, you know, what do you have to say now? Right. I'm not an I told you so kind of person, but this cop-out use of the black swan drives me bonkers.
Yeah.
So the one in China was, you know, how China can respond to these global gray rhinos. In Asia, I get asked a lot to talk about future of work, technology, uncertainty, how to deal with a changing world. I've been doing a lot on climate change. Europe has been more climate change and a little bit of financial stability stuff. So really applying it in real life. And then when other people apply it, I've discovered all these blogs that strangers have done, complete strangers, applying it. And so I've actually built relationships with those people and run those as guest posts on my blog.
Great. That's, you know, that's when you know that your idea has taken hold, right? When it's other people are taking it, using it, applying it. I love it because, you know, we're told so often to find a niche, and your topic is anything but niche. You talk about, you know, you thought you knew what industries and what topics you were talking about, policies and finance and it's everything, but it's a very specific lens. Your expertise is your lens, your framework that applies to this lens, your way of looking at it. So it's become It's truly a big idea book. You know, it's a big idea that we can all take and run with, which is a generous gift. But it sounds like it takes a lot of nurturing and a lot of support. I mean, it's really taken on a life of its own. So you are constantly working to build those relationships, to nurture those ideas, to share and amplify. Is that what you're doing?
A lot of that. And right now I'm actually finishing up a book, a new book that's sort of a sequel to it that actually arose from a lot of the conversations I've been having. One of the questions was, you know, why did this become so big so fast in Asia and take a longer time to catch on in the US?
Yeah.
And there are lots of very interesting, you know, cultural and policy and sociological questions. So I've been delving through lots and lots and lots of research and lots of research, you know, 40 pages to get one sentence. I've had a little bit of help with that. But, you know, and so that's a question I'm going, you know, why do different countries and regions look at risk differently? And that's become so important, as you've seen the responses to the coronavirus.
Yeah.
Another thing that came up, this speaks really to what I mentioned about people wanting to apply it to their personal lives. So I was in Shanghai, summer of 2017, and there were these huge thunderstorms, and it took people like hours and hours, like three times as long as usual, to get to Shanghai to hear me where I was speaking.
Wow.
And this one guy comes up to me, you know, super hip, 20-something, you know, black t-shirt, and holds up my book and asks me for an autograph. And he says, "You helped me so much with my personal life." I was moved. It was amazing. And so I came back to the States really with that in the back of my mind. And, you know, really following up also on the question I would always get in talks was like, how do I apply this to my personal life? And I called up a very dear friend of mine who unfortunately is no longer with us, you know, completely unexpected black swan, you know.
Yeah.
Very sad, but one of the smartest, most generous, kindest, supportive friends I've ever had, and he's like that to everyone he meets. But I told him about this, and he was a pioneer in private equity investing, in sort of ESG investing. And I said, I don't know how to reconcile this. I don't do self-help books. I'm not, you know, that's not really my thing.
Yeah.
I want to respond to this, but I want to do it in a way that fits with my expertise and my brand and what people are looking to me for.
Yeah.
And he said something very interesting. He said, there's a lot bigger connection between personal issues and the big things that you talk about than you realize. He said, our investment committee met last week about the investments that, to put it politely, didn't meet our expectations. And he said, in every single case, the warning signs were there in the due diligence that we did. He said, but it wasn't the product, it wasn't the business model, it wasn't the macroeconomic environment, it wasn't any of the things you usually look at. He said, it was the drunk driving, it was the domestic violence, it was these personal decisions that came up that explained these bad risks that these CEOs had taken. And the headlines have really borne that out the last couple of years with the, you know, the Me Too scandals. You saw the, you know, the head of Overstock.com having to step down because he'd been bragging about the affair with the Russian spy involved with the NRA and all the Trump scandals and things. And the insurance company went to the board and said, we can't insure you if this guy is in charge. Yeah. You know, you see the Uber problems, the WeWork problems, all of those have to do with personal risks among CEOs, bad risk decisions that they took. And I did a piece last fall for Strategy and Business, where I write regularly, about just this question. And it was very interesting. There were a number of boards that were increasingly looking at bad personal risk decisions that CEOs were taking and beginning to act on it in a way that they really haven't in the past. And some of those were Me Too decisions, but other things were not Me Too. It was this bad risk decision making. And there's some academic research showing correlations between the way CEOs manage finance and their personal risk decisions. And so that was part of this big question, because, you know, gray rhino really is a risk management concept as well.
Yeah.
When you see a risk, what do you do about it? Do you deal with it or not? So the new book is really a deep dive into these sort of cultural, organizational, personal, and experience influences. And very interesting questions about demographics, how who you are, you know, your age, your gender, anything affects the decisions you make and why. So knock on wood, I will be finishing the I call it the fugly draft.
Yeah.
That's going to be done within a couple of weeks.
And
so if everything goes to plan, it will come out early next year in
that's
the U.S.
Great.
And it will come out, interestingly, it will come out in China this fall.
Ah, that's
first.
Very interesting. They get there faster.
Well, it was interesting. You know, we found a Chinese publisher first, because my publisher there had been like, when's your next book? When's your next book? Because, you know, it sold hundreds of thousands of copies And they were just really, really excited. And they actually reached out a couple months ago and said, can you make sure there's coronavirus stuff in the book?
Yeah.
And at the time, you know, things were very controversial in China. This was, you know, very early in the year where people were still, you know, upset about the cover-ups at the early stage in Wuhan, which, you know, the government very quickly disowned and moved forward from. So I was a little bit nervous about, you know, the sort of feeling a sense of responsibility. About that. But I wasn't sure if they were going to postpone it or not, because it's going to be quite a while till I can travel to China to promote it in person again. But we just heard from them last week, and they really wanted out this fall as we had originally been speaking. So, but I love the idea of it coming out in China first.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. That's great. Because they were so quick to really embrace your message. So I love that it's the market and the conversations and the people that have driven you have brought this next book topic to you. You know, you're writing it because of what people are coming approaching you with and the questions that you're having. And the process of writing it has been conversations. It has been research. It has been looking at your lens through a different, looking at different things through the same lens, essentially, right? So that's very interesting. That I think that when you get, you know, enough momentum with it, certainly with the big idea book, it's going to generate its own ongoing ideas and filters and books, which is great.
I hope you like it. It's such a great lens, because like, I'm the kind of person who gets bored easily. You might have figured that.
Yeah.
But so, you know, I really wanted something that I could focus on that encompass the diversity of my interests and also the way I look at things using complex systems thinking, which is much more widespread in Asia than it is in the West. And I think that's another part of why it caught on so quickly in China. I think the other thing was that the 2015-2016 market shock was much fresher in their minds. And the other part is that they had a very technocratic culture, and they had been thinking about particularly debt management and things. And when I was asking people in China why has this taken on so much, they said, you know, you found a way to talk about the things that we were already worrying about. And so it took a pandemic for it to start to catch on as much in the West. But I just love that it's a great lens for everything. And the part that I love the most is that it's not just a book that sits on your shelf, on anyone's shelf. It's something that comes alive. People will come to me and ask, okay, you know, what are the biggest gray rhinos? Is this a gray rhino? Is that a gray rhino? And I've started to become very hesitant about answering that question, because it only works if people own it for themselves.
Yes.
I urge them to say, what's my gray rhino? What's the big scary thing with a horn pointed at me coming my way with the name of the problem tattooed on its forehead?
Yep. Because you know at some level what that is. You just, you know, you do. Right. That's very interesting.
And the emotional connection is so important. I mean, you look at Aesop's fables, you look at, you know, children's books and all the animal stories, and, you know, they help us to connect with things in ways that we might not if it were a human doing the same behavior. And I come from policy and finance worlds where it's all about, you know, analysis and numbers and spreadsheets and cost benefit analysis and, you know, stuff that makes people's eyes glaze over. And so, and I need all this, and that stuff is so important, but it's necessary. It's not sufficient. You have to be able to connect to people emotionally. Yeah. And so being able to just close your eyes and, you know, picture that giant image is a way to connect with the problem emotionally, even though in so many cases, people know what they have to do. In fact, they yeah. kind of laugh and roll their eyes where I'm like, oh, you know, that boyfriend that everyone tells you you need to dump? They're like, yeah. You know, like, you know, you need to go to the dentist every 6 months. I mean, it's every 3 months for me because I have celiac disease, you know. But, you know, they like, they're, yes, the stuff that I know, but I just can't get myself to do. And you can only have that emotional connection if you recognize a gray rhino for yourself instead of saying, oh, my boss said I have to do this.
Right. In this case, that metaphor gives you an emotional connection too. I mean, if you're actually going to envision a rhino looking menacingly at you, you will think differently about going to the dentist or whatever it may be. Right. I mean, that's fascinating. The metaphor brings, you know, that meaning that gives it emotional resonance and hence more strength, which is wonderful.
Absolutely.
Oh, well, thanks. This is, any word of advice for someone who wants to, you know, has another big idea that they're trying to share with the world, lessons that you've learned other than don't launch in the middle of the New York primary in 2016.
And that truly nobody could have seen coming.
No, you know? No.
You know, can you, I mean, you know, I think it's, you know, have something that, you know, you are comfortable sticking with for quite some time and being your thing. So have it be a lens that can apply to lots of different things. My good friend Katie Orenstein of the Op-Ed Project talks about her book Little Red Riding Hood and how she broadened that from being about, you know, this little girl in the red hood to being about fairy tales, to being about myths, to being about, you know, empowering women, to being, you know, about popular culture. And so if you think your topic is narrow, you might be surprised once you sit down and think about how broad it is. And, you know, having a big idea as a woman, I found actually was quite challenging. I've even wondered if my author photo not being on the cover in China had anything to do with that. And in Chinese, ta is the she and he, it's the same. So you only get it through context. I really have wondered if that makes a difference. I've got other women author friends who've had sort of, you know, big idea books. One of them went to a publisher who wanted a, you know, smaller travelogue-y kind of thing. A guy. She's like, the guy wanted me to do the girl book, and then she went to a woman who ended up publishing this book that was, you know, ended up, you know, doing very, very well and had a lot of big ideas. I get a lot of pushback from some of the, you know, the Black Swan crowd. Yeah. The people who did not read that book, who it's sitting on their shelf, all they're saying is, oh, that was a Black Swan, so, right. You know, maybe people will think that I actually read that book and they'll think I'm really smart. And, you know, some of those right now are actually coming back going, oh, the pandemic's a white swan. Oh, it's a gray swan. And I'm like, he talked about both of those, you know, very briefly, you know, and kind of disparagingly, to be frank, in his book. And since then has mentioned them a couple times and didn't start talking about white swans in terms of the pandemic until he heard people using gray rhino.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the pandemic's actually more like what in his book was, he called a gray swan, but apparently he didn't want, you know, it's the gray and, you know, a white swan is something that's not dangerous and gray swans are not dangerous either. They're baby swans.
Yeah, right.
They're neither rare nor dangerous unless the mama swan gets mad at you.
Yeah.
So, you know, anyway, be prepared, to get a lot of pushback, to get a lot of snotty know-it-all guys coming up and mansplaining things to you. I've had people come up to me, you know, people, you know, post on LinkedIn, particularly as my weekly column there has gotten more attention, who come up and say, oh, well, you don't know anything about black swans. And I'm like, well, you know, the author of the Black Swan also says this is not a black swan. So be prepared for a lot of mansplaining and a lot of pushback. You've got to have a lot of confidence in yourself to do a big idea book as a woman, but it's worth doing it, because the more of us do it, the more other people will have a path to follow, and it will have examples and role models, and we'll see, you know, what power you can have.
Yeah, that's great. Thank you. Thank you, Michelle. That's great advice. I hope people will follow it.
Thanks. Well, it's always great to talk with you.